Hello, I'm Alberto Salvato. Welcome to Crime Time, a Virginia criminal law podcast. I'm here with Anna Dvorak, Anthony Norse, and Ann Thayer. Enjoy the show.
So here it is, legal disclaimer, because we are lawyers and we've got to write one. So if you are listening to this podcast, thank you. We sincerely hope you are listening to this podcast for its entertainment value and not with the intention of acquiring legal advice for any individual case or situation. I mean, come on, you wouldn't take advice from someone you have never met or spoken to directly, right? If you were bleeding profusely, you wouldn't listen to a podcast in hopes of a bandage somehow materializing over the internet and onto your 3D printer. Seeking actual legal advice can be just as important as a tourniquet. The hosts of this podcast are in no way intending to create an attorney-client relationship with any listener. Sorry, we are sure you all are great people, but we cannot stress enough how little we know of you and your case. And rather than risk an awkward moment, let us just remember we have never met. Nothing on this platform should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation. We are just a group of friends with differing opinions and viewpoints, which we will try to explore through discussions of current events, law changes, and whatever else floats our fancy.
In this episode of Crime Time, we discuss how plea bargains are made. We have a very special guest. David Lord is a deputy Commonwealth attorney for the city of Alexandria. He has been in that office for quite some time. I know I've been practicing for 20 years and I've known him for most of that time. He has a lot of experiences in brokering deals or offering plea bargains when there's a defendant that's facing some jail time or facing a trial. And I will tell you from my experience, he is one of the most thoughtful and thorough prosecutors and brilliant prosecutors out there. Dave, would you like to introduce yourself now that I tried to kiss your butt a little bit?
Thanks, Alberto.
I don't think you could have tried it
harder. You got to be nice.
At least he's not stalking you like you did Barry. All right, that's
right. Yeah, it's okay. I get, you know, it works out.
Well, thanks, Alberto. I've been a prosecutor for 17 years or in our office for 17 years. I love it. I grew up wanting to be a prosecutor. That's all I've done as an attorney. I really enjoy my job. My secondary interest is in ethics. I spend a lot of time researching it, teaching other prosecutors about that area. And it's part of what I'm passionate about. But I really love being in Alexandria and I'm doing what I like.
And we can give a little plug out there. Your boss or I guess the head Commonwealth attorney out in the city of Alexandria, Brian Porter, another individual I've known for a long time, just does a very, really good job out there. And I like to say he was progressive before progressive was cool.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
So that being said, David, you bring up a very interesting point as far as ethics is concerned. And I never really thought about this as far as what goes into the thought process for a prosecutor. And maybe I haven't thought about this because I'm not sure if it's something that's being done throughout Virginia or many other jurisdictions or states, but a very thoughtful analysis of what a prosecutor can actually offer. And I know that you teach classes. I know you've actually written articles on this, and I was hoping you can maybe touch or get into some conversation on that.
Sure, absolutely. I think when you look at how plea bargaining has been done historically, we are all trained as litigators. And when you're trained as a litigator, the idea is you're supposed to maximize the win for your client. And so traditionally, I think how that's been with prosecutors and defense is for prosecutors, we were supposed to get the best charge we could, the biggest charge we could, the longest sentence we could. And for defense attorneys, you to maximize the win for your client, you should try to get your client away with no consequences at all or no conviction, whatever you can. And that's how we always kind of understood that. And that's appropriate for defense attorneys. I think for prosecutors, it really misses the boat of what a win is. It misses the target in terms of who our client really is in the broadest sense of the word. And so I think it's certainly time that we start relooking at what it means to win as a prosecutor and kind of trying to get away from that traditional role model or that traditional model that we've been using, which is built on that adversarial system.
And do you think it's a little bit because, you know, when I started practicing, we did have a few more programs, but when things started, there was really, I would assume, a kind of a punitive message that when someone did something wrong, they had to be punished, whether it was a fine, whether it was going to jail is the only way they were going to learn. If you didn't go to jail, you're going to steal again. You're going to do these things. And, you know, when I started practicing, I was a public defender in Fairfax. It's not a knock on any of the prosecutors, but there's a real incentive to get a conviction, to get at the time, to get some level of punishment, because there had to be, the thought was, is that if you didn't have consequences for what you did, then there wouldn't be any reason for people to stop breaking the law. What is Alexandria doing specifically that maybe changes the needle? Like, how do you think about these charges? Do you think Alexandria has more resources to make more flexible offers? Or how do you look at a case if, let's say, somebody's stolen and it's like the 56th petty larceny? You know, we get people who have multiple misdemeanor petty larcenies. How do you look at a case like that?
Punishment just for punishment's sake, that doesn't make sense to me. That's just a kind of a cruel way to look at things. Punishment really should be looked at as you're trying to get to some broader goal. So from a prosecutor's perspective, I think that goal really should be, yes, what keeps the community safe? And sometimes that means a person has to be locked away for some period of time. And yes, there is within the concept of punishment, there is that element of justice for a victim who's been harmed, et cetera. But that whole goal, when we live in a democratic society with each other, the whole goal of sentencing has to be what restores a person to being an equal member of society, to being a functional member of society. I think that's certainly corresponds with Alexandria's philosophy towards things. That's why we try to have a rehabilitative component to most of our sentencing or outlook. And yes, we probably an element of that is resources. We have a city council and a city government that's committed to that, and a philosophy in our judicial system that's committed to it as well. But it's certainly the approach of our office.
I will tell you, whenever I go into that court, I had this feeling like it's a court for a small town. I'm not sure if I'm the only one that feels that, but it does seem like there's a bit more of a connection to the community in many ways. I think it's because a lot of prosecutors may live nearby there. I see many prosecutors walking through the town, walking through the city, and it's they seem a bit more invested in what goes on. But also, I appreciate the philosophy that it's putting someone in jail is not the end of the job. It's restoring them and putting back into society is where everyone's goal should be. And I don't think some of the bigger jurisdictions have the ability to do that. I don't know if it's not that they don't want to do it. I just don't think that they can, just because the sheer number of cases are out there. And you see a lot more prosecutors being hired in many of these other jurisdictions. And hopefully that'll help. That's refreshing to hear as far as the rehabilitation being a big part of what you view your job as.
And is that something that's being trained throughout Virginia with new prosecutors, that sense of rehabilitation?
I think it's a new emphasis with all of that's happening in criminal justice reform right now. But that's jurisdiction by jurisdiction as to how people approach it. You know, part of what helps in Alexandria is that's the message that's pushed from the top. So Brian, for example, wants all of the prosecutors to be really engaged in the communities. That's why we're at community functions. That's why we're doing those kinds of things. And it's to help make sure that we're going to say, well, we speak for the community, that we actually are trying to know what the community wants, what it wants its prosecutors to be doing.
So how do you balance your ethical obligations when you're figuring out a plea bargain against what a victim or an officer really wants to have happen versus what you think is the right thing to do for that particular defendant in those circumstances? Because there's so much you guys have to balance.
Yeah, that really is one of the toughest components, I think, of a prosecutor's job. So one of the things when I'm training people about ethics, the message I send really early on is it's always important as a prosecutor to keep your eye on who your client is. So we respect the police officers. Many of my friends are police officers. We like police officers, but the police aren't our clients. And it's the same with victims. Like, we are fighting often to get justice for the victims. That's one of the core parts of our jobs. We like victims. We want to make sure that their interests are considered, but the victims are also not our clients. So for example, when I'm formulating a plea offer, our office's policy is always to consult with the investigating detective or officer, to always consult with the victim, which by the way, is also required under the law. And we take those viewpoints into consideration, and oftentimes they're very persuasive in the offer we form, but the offer itself has to be what's in the best interest of my client, and my client is the community at large. And if that means rehabilitation over punishment, even if the victim really wants punishment because that's the position they're coming from, sometimes that means that you can't go along with that as a prosecutor because your client is not the victim. But we're always going to be very, very concerned with trying to make sure that the victim's viewpoint is heard and taken into consideration.
Do you run into situations with police officers? How do you set the boundary for them? Because you work with police officers all the time. They may have a feeling like, we want the book thrown at this guy, David. This guy's he's been doing this forever. He's always, you know, he's mentally ill, he's not taking his meds, you know, or whatever it is, but he's constantly like throwing rocks and breaking stuff. And, you know, and he's injuring people by accident sort of, but, you know, he really is, you know, how do we, you know, with this guy finally needs to be punished. Like, how do you set boundaries? One with police officers who are, while they work closely with you, they are still just witnesses. They're not your client. And how do you explain to them that even if they disagree with you, that they respect your decision?
I think relationship is probably the most important thing. And it does help that I've been a prosecutor for over 15 years. Like, to have those relationships, it enables me to have probably more honest conversations with the police and to get to a good place there, and for them to understand that even if I'm doing something they might not like, that they can still respect the place that I'm coming from. So a lot of that is just the relationship that you build over time. I think there are ways that you demonstrate respect to a police officer. So for example, one is going to be reaching out and asking them, what is your opinion about this case? How do you look at it? What do you think about the defendant? A lot of times you'll be really surprised. Like a police officer who arrests a defendant is not necessarily always wanting to get the book thrown at them. Many, many police officers who approach me and say, hey, this person needs help. They have a substance abuse problem or whatever. What kind of help can we get them? Even though they just arrested the individual. And I think the other issue with respect is just never talking down to the police, like having thoroughly explaining where you're coming from. And it usually you can get, if you treat individuals in that fashion, you can usually get a person around to at least respecting the position you're taking, even if they may disagree with it. But I'll tell you, at least in Alexandria, and I don't know, I've never worked in another jurisdiction, I've never really had a problem with police officers when I want to take a rehabilitative approach with the case, being extremely opposed to it, because they're seeing the same people come through the system over and over and over again. And obviously, the approach that we've taken with those individuals isn't working today. Why not try something new? That argument can oftentimes be convincing for a police officer.
Well, it's keeping that line of communication open the entire time and not, you know, I know in some jurisdictions, the police officers feel as if they've been thrown under the bus. So they have already lost that respect with the prosecutors or the Commonwealth attorneys in those jurisdictions. So when they're not approached the way they should be approached and asked, you know, listen, this is what you're, we're asking you, what do you want? And then if they don't have the evidence, they have to be educated on that. Sometimes that happens. And doing that in a respectful way goes a long way. But I think one thing that really needs to happen is that the confidence has to be between the two, between the police officers and the Commonwealth attorneys. That has to be strong and that has to be maintained. And as soon as that breaks down, I think that there's always going to be a family feud between the two. Because let's face it, they're it's one big family, the Commonwealth attorneys and the police. They have to work together. And if they're not getting along, I think you end up having prosecutor will have a hard time getting their agenda through. Or at least respected by the police.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that helps, I think, with that, Alberto, for example, if let's say that something is going on in a case where I'm not able to prosecute it, maybe the police have done something that would lead to a motion to suppress that should be granted, or there's insufficient evidence, I never just kind of leave it with the police of saying, hey, you messed up, or this case, we just don't have enough evidence, and that's that. I've always tried to either call the police officer, bring them in, or explain in detail kind of why I've reached that conclusion and never talk down to someone or just assume, hey, I'm the lawyer, I know the law, so my answer is what goes. I think if you take the time to explain it, most officers will appreciate it and respect where you're coming from.
Police officers, in my opinion, in many of the jurisdictions, the best ones are not necessarily the ones that are the most aggressive. They're the ones who are, they understand that their job in many ways has completed once they make the arrest, once they prepare that package, they prepare that case, and then they hand it over to a Commonwealth attorney. And the best ones are like the ones that have that confidence to go forward and say, look, I trust the people who are handling this. And I think it may help that Brian Porter was a former police officer. So I'm sure that has to have something to do with the way things were created, or at least the approach that has been trained for you guys.
I think you're spot on. And I would hope, I think it's probably easier too. Like if I've been a prosecutor for 15 years and that's all I've done as an attorney, hopefully that brings with it some degree of a sense with the police officers that I'm not just trying to get rid of cases, or that I'm, you know, on the far end of a spectrum or something like that. I mean, I hopefully that carries some degree of credibility, just like Brian's experience with law enforcement does.
So, David, I think you have a journal article coming out in January with the Georgetown Journal of Legal Ethics. So do you want to talk to us a little bit about that and how it interacts with like what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. The basic idea is that plea bargaining in the criminal context is very, very different than bargaining in most legal contexts, or how we understand bargaining in our society in general. So bargaining in criminal plea bargaining, it's very asymmetric. In other words, there's one side that has really disproportionate power. And it's probably weird for me to say this as a prosecutor. People don't hear this a lot. But a prosecutor has a lot more power when they approach plea bargaining, at least from my perspective, than the defense does. So I look at it this way. I say, well, what is it that I can
unless
offer?
Unless we have a video of someone else doing it or something. Right? <That's>
I look at like, what is it that I can offer a defendant as a prosecutor? Like my decision might be whether that individual goes to jail, whether they're going to be classified as a felon for the rest of their life. Those decisions that I make are going to have all kinds of collateral consequences. They might be deported because of the decision that I'm making. They might lose their public housing benefits, all of these types of things. And then you say, well, what does a defendant really have to offer me? A defendant can essentially save me time and allow me to go focus on other cases. And those two things, when they stack up against each other, the way I classify in the article, it's like a David versus Goliath battle where David wins, or excuse me, where Goliath wins every single time. And that's not a just system. That's not a system that I think we would be proud of. So the question becomes, well, how do we fix that? A lot of the things are ideas that you've talked about on this podcast before, for example, like the reforms or eliminating or getting rid of mandatory minimums, all those kinds of things. But those reforms, like, they only change things at the margins. Prosecutors still have a tremendous amount of power. Prosecutors are still going to have a tremendous amount of power, even with those reforms that are being initiated. And so if you want to make fundamental change in the system, you've got to have prosecutors fundamentally being willing to change. So it's really that, how do we develop a very strong sense of ethics and kind of a value-laden approach to the plea bargaining? And you really have to have prosecutors who are willing to take a step away from how we've traditionally done plea bargaining, or that system's never going to change. You're always going to have a system with one side that has significantly more power. And you might say, well, what's the problem with that? Why does it matter that prosecutors have a lot more power? Well, you get into a situation, let's say that a person is found with a gun on them and they're a convicted felon. And the decision I make as a prosecutor can mean they either go to jail for a mandatory minimum period of 5 years, or they get a misdemeanor with no jail time. And I say, hey, plead to this misdemeanor with no jail time, even though you believe that you're innocent or not guilty, or you have this suppressible issue, or I'm going to indict you with this offense that's going to result in 5 years in the penitentiary. That individual isn't really faced with a real meaningful choice. There really is only one choice in that situation. You take the misdemeanor, no jail, because you can't take the risk of 5 years in the penitentiary. That's not a justice system that we can really be proud of. It's not a justice system that's concerned with getting to the right answer, the best answer, promoting the most just outcome. Those reforms around the edges, of which I'm a huge supporter, our office has been always supportive of prosecutorial reform. Those reforms aren't going to be enough. You really got that changes has to start with prosecutors.
Well, what's hard is I think it's got to be voluntary. I mean, we see in other industries that, you know, asking people to voluntarily reduce emissions, do things like that, it doesn't really work all the time. I mean, there has been a push in recent years for prosecutors to be held, you know, with certainly withholding evidence or something like that. And discovery rules is that there's an ethical consequence for a prosecutor who hides evidence and doesn't give over Brady, or, you know, makes it more likely that someone could be convicted of something they shouldn't be. But so much of plea bargaining, at least in my experience, and I've had a few cases in Alexandria, but it's odd because I grew up here and I actually interned with Melinda's office my first year out of law school, but I've mostly been in Fairfax, Arlington, and Loudoun and Prince William. But it's relationships that you build with Commonwealth attorneys, building trust with them. And then, you know, being able to pitch your mitigation half the time, because many of the times, as we all know, you've got a video of my guy in Target stealing something and he's waving at the video and it's pretty much, you got the receipts. This is not hard to make. And you're banking on your relationships that when you don't have any legal issues, which leads to, in some ways, it's uneven results, right? Because prosecutors are people. And so as much as they would want to look at cases similarly, if another lawyer doesn't do the same thing or put in enough mitigation or some reason pisses off the prosecutor for some reason, then you're in a situation where that person who's probably similarly situated gets a worse deal. And I don't know, I mean, prosecutors can be part of that, but how would you see changing the ethics of prosecutors to sort of fix that uneven scale?
You know, it's interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking about one of the greatest frustrations I have with the criminal justice system. There is so much arbitrariness to it. So a lot of it, like you just pointed to, it depends what jurisdiction you get caught committing your crime. It depends which prosecutor gets assigned to your case. If you are indigent, it depends which defense attorney you get assigned. So there is just a lot of arbitrariness, and it sometimes makes the justice system feel like it isn't as just as it could be. I'm big into the idea, though, that norms and values can be learned and taught. You know, one of the things I think is helpful is if we're willing to have more conversations, which I think we're having as a society, but certainly as prosecutors, about what basic values mean to us. So let me give you an example based on what you were just talking about, or something I kind of heard behind it. And it's that idea of, like, what is fair? So for prosecutors really want to be fair. They want to do the right thing. Most, I would assume most of them do, all the ones I know. So prosecutors want to be fair. And one of the ways that we interpret what does it mean to be fair is we want to treat everybody the same, right? So we have these standard dispositions and everybody gets treated with that standard disposition. And we're starting to have, I think, a more recognition in our society that treating everybody exactly the same is not same is not the same thing as fair, right? So that willingness to be actually willing to listen to defense attorneys when they're talking about mitigation testimony is really important, because there is an individual, you know, let's say you have two individuals who get caught stealing for the first time. And if your office's standard disposition is every person gets petty larceny, 30 days all suspended for that first theft, for one individual, that might mean embarrassment and a record. For the other individual, that might mean they get deported. Is that really fair just because you've treated the same people the same way? So we have to be willing to engage those conversations, understanding the prosecutors are trying to get to the right answer. They're trying to uphold values that are important, like fairness, but we need to be willing to think about those values in different ways than we've thought about them historically, throughout our careers, et cetera.
So how do you balance somebody, for instance, who, whether they had a court appointed or a retained attorney, did a bunch of things to mitigate their case going into it versus somebody who maybe didn't have the resources to do those things or had an attorney that didn't have them do those things? How do you balance out those things and the ability to give you guys what you need to maybe do something different? Because it's not the same for everybody, and it's not always a person who's charged and facing the consequences. It's not always their fault if they don't know or aren't aware or aren't told, hey, this could help you if you do these things. Prosecutor might do something a little bit better for you.
Yeah, that's really tough. It's almost easier when a defendant is pro se in that sense, because you can make whatever offer you're going to ultimately make. With respect to a defense attorney, we can't do a defense attorney's job for them, unfortunately, right? So we can't hunt down what that mitigation testimony would be. All we can do is have a willingness to listen to it. And that is one of the things the system needs to get better at, is making sure that we all can do our jobs better, whether that's defense or prosecution. That's a very tough question, man.
Go ahead, Anne.
I was just saying, speaking for our sort of, you know, our listeners, some of which are defense attorneys, you know, there is a certain level of, if I have a drunk in public, I might say to my client before we go to court, like, try to get 25 hours of community service done. Maybe we can get it, you know, dropped, and so you don't have it on your record. You can do an expungement. And that's sort of the basic kind of mitigation situation. But what, you know, you guys must see just a ton of lawyers coming in with people saying, hey, I've done this much community service, I've done these driving classes, or I've done this anger management class. Is there something that when someone comes in an individual case that you look at? I mean, I kind of wing it sometimes and tell my clients, like, look, you know, if your crime was disrespecting a woman or an intimate partner or anything like that, you know, perhaps taking, not, and I don't mean disrespecting, like, I mean, not like beating a woman or something like a domestic assault situation, but more of like a phone threats and other things like that, that you hear, or like the harassment. The cases that I think that they should get community service at places like the Women's Center, or take a class about, I think that they should do something that's sort of related, because I think that it matters to the prosecutor that they're trying to actually educate themselves on what they're doing, instead of just like, I, you know, helped set up chairs at church or something like that. When a prosecutor is listening to a defense attorney about a certain charge, what kind of perks their interest? I mean, this is just more of a defense attorney saying, what are you looking for in a mitigation?
Yeah, so different prosecutors are probably going to be looking for slightly different things. One thing that's kind of uniform is, first off, that the defendant really gets it, like evidence that they get that what they did was wrong. So for example, I'm personally very fond of letters of apologies. Now, the letter of apology, though, it's really helpful to see it be genuine. And I have seen all kinds of letters of apology, from what is clearly just a, I'm checking the box to say I did this, versus a letter where someone really genuinely gets it. And frankly, oftentimes when I have that letter of apology and I'm able to go to the police officer or to the victim and show genuine remorse, that's going to also help move the victim or the police officer to come closer to a position where we can get resolution. That's certainly one component of it. We're ultimately trying to get around to that this kind of whatever the behavior was isn't going to happen again. So if there's an underlying issue that led to that criminality, that's really important to me. So substance abuse, for example, is a huge one. Substance abuse and mental health are probably the genesis of, I don't know, 90% of all crimes, I would guess, you know, or a huge, huge portion. So what has that individual done to address the issues so we can have some level of assurance that it won't happen again? So I'm looking, for example, like if a person has gone to in a AA or secular equivalent of that, that's going to be persuasive to me because it's going to show that they're taking the issue seriously before they go to court versus the court just ordering them to do it, something like that. Community service is good, but community service doesn't necessarily get to the underlying problem that brought them to the court in the first place.
One of the things now that with 298.02, that code section, I think you can dictate the mitigation that would be relevant to that particular prosecutor. So, and that's the new law that passed. It became in July for many people, 298.02. It allows the Commonwealth, I know, I'm so proud of myself. I knew that code section. I don't even have a cheat sheet. But anyway, it allows the defense attorney and the prosecutor.
I just wanted to see how many more times you were going to say it.
By the way, did I mention that Virginia code section?
We're just going to edit.
It allows the Commonwealth and the defense attorney to reach an agreement where an individual can earn their redemption in many ways. They could either get a case dismissed or reduced to a lesser charge, which may not have the same consequences that the original charge would have had.
Well, so I think expungement that expungement is huge. On
oh, and the possibility of expungement. Yeah.
Yeah. That, by the way, in my opinion, is the single best of all the criminal justice reform initiatives. That is the single best one we've seen adopted in Virginia to improve what we can offer. For so many reasons. Like one of the frustrating things as a prosecutor is you get faced with conduct and you sometimes are choosing between, I have to make this a felony or a misdemeanor. And when you talked about that, navigating the victims and the police officer's expectations, breaking that felony down to a misdemeanor, for lack of a better word, selling that to the victim or to the police officer can oftentimes be really difficult when a defendant has done something pretty egregious. But if a defendant has to use your words to earn that by demonstrating conduct that helps address or resolve what brought them to the court in the first place, or to resolve something like restitution that helps make the victim whole before they get the benefit of that reduction or as a condition of it, it's going to make a lot of those cases that were really unresolvable before or that made you choose between really dramatic outcomes much easier to get to a fair and appropriate resolution for everybody.
So that to me, and I agree with you, that's an awesome tool that we have because, you know, I'm all about paying your debt to society and actually having a good result from that. Because
you heard it here. Alberto Salvato is all about paying your debt to society.
All right, that came out.
You're a criminal defense attorney.
So what I mean by that is, thank you.
You're welcome.
What I mean by that is how many times we have people go into jail, they end up serving their time, and then when they come out, they still can't get a job. You know, they'll never be able to get back to a norm. Even if they didn't go to jail, a record's going to keep them from getting a job, a misdemeanor, whatever it is. Now with this ability to, you know, do what you have to do, meet some conditions and then pay that debt to society and then actually be forgiven somewhat is huge. And that's something that's been lacking. So
that's, you know, true for the new expungement statute starting in 2025 too, is if you have convictions like larceny and things like that, whether it's felony or misdemeanor, you're going to be able to get those sealed down the road, which has never been allowed before, even though other states do it. So.
And the example I always use, it has nothing to do with expungement, but I was going down this path, was Michael Vick, when he did his jail time he went to the federal penitentiary and he served his jail time. And then when he came out, the only thing he could possibly do is play football. And a lot of people were like, no, I don't want him to do what he did. I was like, well, wait a second. Either he's paid his debt to society by serving his jail time or not. You can't keep punishing him. Let him play football. Let him redeem himself. That's why I really dig that 298.02 code section in so Virginia.
David, what do you think about open discovery and giving defense attorneys and their clients access to the evidence you have to help them figure out, hey, is this really a case we want to fight, or is it a plea bargain type situation, or what should we do in this particular case? And at the same time, there's a lot of games that get played with plea agreements sometimes. If you know a witness isn't going to be there, or they don't want to come from out of state, or whatever the case may be, you might try to offer something better to resolve it. And then the defendant's kind of left going, well, do I take this and do better with this? Or do I continue and take the risk on whether this person comes the next time? So there's all those things that are in play when we're trying as defense attorneys to educate our clients on the pros and cons of which way they should go with it. How do you prosecutors consider those type things?
Let me start with latter, the two that you referenced. So if we're talking about getting away from gamesmanship, that's the starting point. For example, when I am training prosecutors or the people that I supervise, I always say, don't ever bluff. Don't make a plea offer if you're not prepared to follow up with it. Because implicit behind any plea offer is the idea that if it's rejected, I'm ready, willing, and able to go to trial. I'm going to be able to produce the witnesses and the evidence that would support a finding of guilt. And the first time that you kind of pull one of those antics as a prosecutor where you know a victim isn't going to show up and you make a plea offer and it gets rejected and then you have to drop the case anyway, you've lost all credibility with that defense attorney. And it really is all about credibility. So if I make an offer to a defense attorney, I'm hoping that they would know and be able to tell their client convincingly, if you reject this offer, we are going to trial. They're going to have the evidence that they need. So it comes down to that level of credibility. I think that's really important.
We always have been taught, and I think we've all heard this, you don't take the pleas or enter that agreement until you see the whites of the victim or the officer's eyes. Like somebody taught me that very early on in my career. I can't remember. And so they're like, yeah, you don't take that till you make sure they're there, you figure out what's going on. And so that's something that's always sticks in my head.
I always tell people too, and that everything always comes to light in our job in the criminal justice system. So let's say you had a victim who died or disappeared and you thought that you could hold on to that information. Things never get held on to, and that eventually is going to come out. And you always have to ask yourself, how am I going to look to the defense attorney, to the court, et cetera, when it becomes apparent that I was holding on to that information? And even if I didn't have to tell the defense attorney that, what you should do and what you have to do are two very different things. So I always say never hold on to things because they're going to come to light at the end of the day. You pointed though to another issue, which is the discovery thing. That's really, really important. So a lot of discovery is a trial right. It's not necessarily a right that you're going to have prior, in terms of a constitutional sense, prior to a plea bargain, that sort of thing. But I've always tried to approach it. If we're trying to convict somebody of something, if we're trying to put them in jail, if we're trying to get a criminal conviction, any of those types of things, shouldn't we at least want that fight to be fair, so to speak? And what's a fair fight? Well, it's certainly having a defense attorney know everything that the prosecution has in terms of their evidence. So our office, we give full open file discovery. I do that always before I make a plea offer in the case, because I feel like a defense attorney shouldn't be put into a position of having to advise a client with incomplete information and not really knowing what the evidence is at the end of the day. It's just not a system you could be proud of if that's the type of games you're playing.
And I think we all can say that we've come a long way with that from when we all started practicing, where many jurisdictions, we got verbal discovery 10, 15, 20 minutes before we had to figure out if our clients were taking a plea, waiving on a felony, going to trial. I mean, I think you guys agree, you've dealt with that earlier.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's gotten a lot better over the last few years as jurisdictions start to open up with giving us the discovery. And I think it helps resolve a lot more cases. I mean, it does send a lot of cases to trial when there's issues, but it also, I think, you can point to the video or the witness statements and say, hey, this is what they're going to use against you. And it makes it easier when they see those types of evidence or witness statements to say, okay, I don't want to risk that. Let's try to sort this out.
What also kills me is I think it seems to be a fundamental misunderstanding in jurisdictions now where prosecutors are giving us offers, but also, you know, setting cases out. So it's like, here's your offer at the first court date. You've gotten your discovery ahead of time. I mean, but we've given you the offer because we wanted to see who was going to come and respond to our subpoenas. And then we set in some jurisdictions, we set a status date or we set a new prelim date. But I think there's sometimes a misconception that more cases are working out as misdemeanors or null process or other things like that in the lower court. But I think part of it is if you have imperfect information, when I started, it was like, hey, you've got 15 minutes to talk to your, when I was a public defender, we had 4 to 6 prelims a day. And they were like, you've got like 15 minutes to figure this out and talk to your client with an interpreter. And he either takes this or we're going to go to a prelim and then we're going to set it for a trial. And so a lot more things.
Or even null process and direct indict with other things if they're not doing.
Right. You know. If they're not going to take it, and which is not fair for many of our clients who are dealing with the criminal justice system, sometimes for the first time, you know, sometimes for the 15th time, but it's not fair to make a big decision that's going to affect their lives in a matter of seconds. And I think a lot more cases got indicted back when I first started than they do now, because it was just sort of trial by ambush and just sort of trying to twist someone's arm and saying, what's what we're going to do? And everything's just going to be like the Wild West. And the prosecutors, just as we said before, held a lot of the cards. So I do think there is a misconception by some people that cases are working out more in a defendant's favor, but I think we're having more time to consider things in other jurisdictions, so the results are more just.
And kind of following up on that, David, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about a situation where, for example, an officer has left the force, you don't know if he's coming back, and the prosecutor makes an offer that expires before the actual hearing date or preliminary hearing date or trial date. So you don't know if the witnesses are even going to show up, but the prosecutor is putting the defendant in a position, take this offer now or roll the dice later. Do you think there's any problem with that kind of a situation?
Yeah, I think it goes back to that credibility thing, which like I wouldn't make those kind of offers because when my bluff gets called, I don't want to be developing a bad reputation with that defense attorney or the court. So I'm going to know in any time I'm making an offer that at the end of the day, I can produce that evidence. And a lot of the times I will, if there's uncertainty, I'll let the defense know that. Like I'll let them know this witness, just so you know, has moved out of state. Or I'll have this witness has moved out of state, but I will be able to produce them. If push comes to shove, it will just be a great expense. And that's why you're getting this better offer than I would otherwise make, that sort of thing. But I'm always going to be candid about it if there's a problem with witness availability.
Here's something that I've dealt with, and it comes up all the time, but you get an offer from a prosecutor, and as a defense attorney, you know something that they don't know. And we're always confronted with this.
No,
yeah. But we're confronted with this notion that if we would probably get a better offer if we tell the prosecutor this certain bit of information, or we may have a chance of winning the case if we go to trial, but we could also still lose. You know, I think we could all say, as far as the defense attorneys here on this podcast, that there's a handful of prosecutors that we certainly know not to key them into this point, because they will do everything to try to fix it. And there's others who will say, all right, now that you told me, I think that maybe we could resolve it in a little bit, you know, a different fashion, or maybe get a no pros because it wasn't done correctly. And I'm not sure, are there any ethics behind that? Or is the prosecutor obligated to, I hate to say obligated, but should they try to fix that problem that they're keyed into it?
I don't think that, you mean if a weakness in their case is highlighted for them by
yes,
the defense attorney?
Perfect. You're so eloquent compared to me.
I would start by saying, like, if a defense attorney comes to me with information that shows my case is fundamentally flawed, there are many times where I've dropped a case or not pursued a particular charge because of the information that the defense attorney has given me. But I understand where you're coming from, which is, it gets back to that strategy of conflict of, if you give me your inside game plan, am I going to use it to your detriment? I don't know. You know, it's the ethical rule. You have to provide your client competent representation. So if you know there's a flaw in your case that you have the capacity to correct, sure, you have to correct it. But the prosecutor's job fundamentally is to do justice. So I can't give you a universal answer, Alberto. It would really depend situationally. But I can tell you there are many circumstances I've had where a defense attorney has come and shared that information with me, and it has fundamentally changed how I look at the case.
And I wasn't
actually,
go ahead.
I've had a case where I had a situation like that, and I told the prosecutor, there's a problem with the case, but I'm reluctant to tell you. And the prosecutor actually said, tell me what it is, and I'm not going to fix it if I think it is an actual problem. And he actually followed through and said, yep, that's a problem. And he dismissed the case.
Yeah, because in my way of thinking, you never know. There's no such thing as a guaranteed win. So you may have this flaw and you may know this flaw exists and you may wait to use it in trial and it doesn't matter. I mean, we've all lost cases we thought were winners and we've all won cases we thought were losers. I think that happens on both sides of the courtroom. So I'd rather, like I said, there are some prosecutors that you know, and you're one of those, David, that I know that if I came up to you and said, look, this is a problem, that you would say, yeah, I agree, and come up with either a different solution, whether or not that's a dismissal or not. But there's others that I know would really utilize that against me. So
I think it's one of those tough things. It's like a motion to strike when it's denied, but the judge kind of sends that message, not at this point in the case. And then you have to say, well, crap, do I want to put some evidence on, or am I going to win if I just rest with my reasonable doubt here? And you have to weigh that out. And I think we've all done that where the judge was in sync with what we were thinking and it got dismissed. And we've done it where they didn't rule that way. And we're like, darn it, we should have put that evidence on. And it's one of those, it's a whole balancing thing. The criminal justice system is not a game, but there's a lot of moving pieces that we're all balancing at any given time. And it's part of what your experience and your relationships and your knowledge and all of those things, what it's all based off of. And I think that's one of the things we have to work hard to try to do the best that we can and trust in the people that we can. And if you've had relationships or experiences with people where you don't think it would benefit your client. Unfortunately, just like the prosecutors probably have lists of all of us that are like, hey, we can't trust what this person says, or
you're right,
this person's bluffing, they're not really ever going to go to a trial, or whatever it is, or they're misrepresenting what we told them in a meeting or whatever. I mean, judges have lists, we have lists, everybody has lists of attorneys they like and respect and ones they don't. And that's true for any job or any part of life. So I mean,
reputation goes a long way in every job, and your word is your, you know, if you have a good reputation, that goes a long way in the way you deal with your opponent, the way you deal with a judge. Your reputation is gold.
You know, Alberto, let me give you an example of how I see what you're talking about happen a lot. In a case, like, let's say you have a victim who gets on social media after the crime is happening, or is texting or something like that, where they're doing things that might intimate that they're, it would call their testimony into question. Like they're showing either bias towards the defendant, or they're suggesting that they made something up, that sort of thing. We as a prosecutor aren't going to always know that or be aware of those types of communications that are going on. You as the defense attorney might have that information. Well, I don't want to put a person on the stand that I'm worried about whether they are telling the truth or the full story. And that puts you in a difficult position because, yes, if you show me that text message or that social media post, I might look at it and say, I don't want to put this person on the stand because I no longer have confidence that they're going to be, that they're testifying to is truthful. But then the other worry is I can also go to the victim ahead of time, ask them to explain it, and they're going to explain it away to me in a way that allows me to address it. So yes, it is a difficult balance, but I would say on the whole, that information has been, I would say more often than not, having that information has inured to the benefit of the defendant than caused them harm, at least when it's come to cases I've had.
And I think it really just comes down to the trust with the prosecutor. I mean, we started with relationships, and it really comes down to that. It's like our whole profession, whether you do criminal law or civil law, I do civil law too. I mean, you dealing with attorneys and trying to deal with the truth, and it's, you know, there are people that we trust and there's people that you don't. And we're all officers of the court, and I would hope that everybody's trying to do their best. But I mean, there's definitely, you know, there's situations where you feel like you're backstabbing. Taking the apology letter, like there are certain prosecutors, you know, that I wouldn't suggest to my client that a tactic we could take as a you know, to try to get a good plea bargain is to use an apology letter. If I think I have any defenses, there are certain prosecutors that I feel like would turn around and take that apology letter and use it against us, like in the court, right? Because it's, you know, basically it's not that I'm sorry that you feel hurt by that punch I made in your face. Like it's a real apology. So it really admits to the crime. And it's really kind of it is a settlement negotiation, for lack of a better term.
But it also comes down to pride in our work. So none of us want to have surprises in a trial. None of us want to put a witness up that isn't credible or makes us look stupid for not knowing the information or being prepared. I think when you have a witness testify, we all kind of want to be under the assumption that we know what that evidence is going to be, right? And by not knowing that, you're taking chances, and then it looks bad on you when it goes really bad. You could develop a reputation. Oh, they're going to put up witnesses that don't tell the truth, or that change their stories, or are making things up, or, you know, whatever it may be. And so it's like I said before, it's the same with any type of job. Some people take pride in it and they're going to do everything they can to protect their reputation, to fight for their client and keep the respect of the prosecutors and the judges. And while at the same time, providing zealous advocacy for their clients. And then there's other people that just don't care or don't pay attention or don't know better or don't, whatever the reasons are, right? And I think we've all seen that in court. And again, it comes down to your experience and what you value.
I mean, I'll ask you this question. What tools, I know that we've talked about different mitigation things, but what tools did you wish to a certain extent that you had, because maybe you would get a better offer if you knew that certain programs existed, or, you know, certain things like restorative justice programs existed in the community, that you would feel more comfortable making a better offer because these things existed and the defendant would be able to do them. Is there certain tools that you wish you had in our community in Alexandria, for instance, that if you had them, it would make it easier for you to feel like you could serve the community without necessarily I'll use the word felonizing, which I just made up, but felonizing a person.
Did
so
you just trade places with Alberto?
I did.
I would have gone with felonizing. I'm sorry.
But is there anything, if you had a perfect world of tools, what would you want to add to Alexandria's?
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking through a couple of different resource limitations that cause a lot of issues. So two come to mind. So first has to do with, we'll talk about substance abuse issues or substance abuse treatment. I think a lot of people would be surprised to find out that there are oftentimes wait lists for substance abuse treatment in our communities. So if you're in a program like the treatment court, that's great. You're going to get the treatment that you're lined up in need. But there are all kinds of individuals in our communities who need substance abuse treatment and aren't getting it. And if all that's available are NA meetings, which are great, but that's not enough for many people. If that's all that they're going to have, it's not going to get to the underlying problem. From a resource perspective, one of the biggest problems I think that we have in a community like Alexandria, where the cost of living is inordinate, has to do with like simple things like housing. So you have a lot of crime just has to do with, well, for example, in the substance abuse problem or the substance abuse context, a lot of what we experience, for example, in a treatment court is people not having stable residence or stable housing. So they can't really get their life together to be that fully rehabilitated individual that's functioning in society. And so if they're getting released without that, they're just going to cycle back through the system again. Stable housing, probably the single biggest need that if you had would help address some of those problems. And a person who is having to worry about where they're going to live or sleep for the night can't be really thinking about their long-term recovery. That's not the primary consideration for them. So some of those basic resources are core.
Cool.
Awesome.
So any last words?
It's kind of funny that it got quiet because you have crickets in the background. That's good.
You hear them, okay?
I hear them.
Sorry.
Well, no, it's good. It adds ambiance to our podcast.
We've had ambulances, cats, crickets.
Motorcycles.
Had a lot of things. So
motorcycles.
Did we say that twice? I think we did, Tony. Anyway.
Let the man speak.
David, are there any do's or don'ts that you would want a defense attorney? Is there any real pet peeve that you think prosecutors have from defense attorneys when we're trying to negotiate? I know sometimes you hear prosecutors saying, don't just tell me they're a good guy. Like, give me some other things or things that you really, really do like and value. Like, is there any messages you can send on ways to communicate and work with a prosecutor to try to get your client a great outcome?
Yeah, I think authenticity is really key. So if you are coming to a prosecutor and every single one of your client, that conviction is going to be the end of the world for them, it loses credibility and it loses volume. I think back to it when I started on the traffic docket, I had a defense attorney, it was a public defender who I had a really fantastic relationship with. And she came to me in a case where the person would unquestionably normally get jail time and said to me, jail is going to devastate this individual for the following reasons. And that's all she needed to say to me because she had that great relationship of credibility. And she didn't come and say that to me in every single case. And so that was a situation where we were able to make that jail go away. So authenticity, I think, is really key.
Did you hear that, Alberto?
I am the most authentic person out there. You know, it
I'm
is
just
true.
Making sure you were listening.
I appreciate it.
He thinks you don't protest too much.
the thing with me, and it's funny because I have the same, a lot of my clients have immigration consequences that or dangers with convictions. And I'm like, I do feel like a broken record a lot, but I can back it up. So oftentimes I'm like, look, this person has DACA. This person has no papers or, you know, we all know. And I think prosecutors have really come around to knowing what's, you know, crime of moral turpitude, what to avoid, what. Yeah, so even though it's a broken record, I do think that there's change and people still listen to it.
With the immigration consequences, having more information that you can show the prosecutor to show what is the specific consequence that this is going to have, not just kind of a hey, it's going to be bad for him because he'll be convicted sort of thing, is going to be very convincing. In our office, one of the reforms that Brian instituted was specifically allowing us to consider collateral consequences, but kind of spelling out how we go about considering them, which does require a defense attorney to kind of show specifically why there are collateral consequences and how you know it, so that we aren't just, I don't want to say falling for it in any situation, that it really is a situation where those collateral consequences are well established. Because you do have that conflict between wanting to treat people the same way, and you don't want to get to what one of you pointed about earlier is what happens when you have a lawyer, a defendant who has a really well-resourced lawyer. And so they're able to get away from that standard disposition because they put all that legwork in. So that's why we have those standard dispositions in the first place. And yet balancing that against wanting to consider someone's individual circumstances and not devastate their life over one mistake.
Well, David, we really appreciate having you. You have to send us your journal article when it gets published so we can take a look. I know we've all had cases with you. I know my aunt used to work in the office with you. Hey, Kathleen. And we really appreciate you taking time to come on with us. I don't know that ethics is always something that prosecutors want to talk about because I think it's a little bit scary for them. And they don't ever want to be called out for something like that or give the impression that they're anything but ethical. And so I think it's awesome that you were willing to talk to us about it and share some light on how you perceive things from your side of the fence.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Thanks for joining us on Crime Time. Please join us again for our next episode.